Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet, by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Return of the Unexplained. Many thanks if you sent an email recently or a donation to the show, and if you sent a guest suggestion, thank you very much indeed. Keep your guest suggestions coming. You can email me through the website, theunexplained.tv, and when you go there, you can just follow the link for messages, or indeed donations, and send me a message from there. And if you make a guest suggestion, can you put guest suggestion in the subject line so I know exactly where to put the email? And, you know, we've got some very good guest suggestions coming in, so please keep them coming. I'm determined to give you the people you want to hear on this show. Now, no shout-outs this time, apart from a very nice email I've just had from John in Derbyshire, in Buxton, formerly working in Newbury, Berkshire, and Pat as well. So John and Pat, nice to know that you're there and part of this show, and thanks very much for the very kind email. It was nice to read this morning. If you want to email me, theunexplained.tv, that's the website, that's the way to do it. And you know that I see all of your emails and I do respond to them. The guest on this show is somebody who talks differently and authoritatively about the state of finance, the state of government, and the stuff that really happens behind the scenes. She is controversial, she is knowledgeable, and the reason for her knowledge is the fact that she was at the very nexus of government and finance in the US. Catherine Austin Fitz, founder of Solari and the Solari Report. She served as managing director and member of the board of directors of the Wall Street investment bank Dillon Reed & Company Incorporated. She also served as assistant secretary of housing and federal housing commissioner at HUD, a government department in the Bush administration, the first one in the US, and was the president and founder of Hamilton Securities Group Incorporated. So she's got a great track record, not only in government, and there's a story, as you will hear, behind that, but also in finance, which is at the heart of everything. I really wanted to try and get a handle on what is happening with this world of ours at the moment. There is so much instability around, and nobody's entirely sure whether we are staring down the barrel of yet another recession, maybe a crash. What is going on? What are the political movements going on? And who's pulling the strings? Who's calling the shots, I guess we need to be asking. So the person to be asking that, I think, is Catherine Austin Fitz. Thank you very much for your communications. Keep them coming. TheUnexplained.tv is the website, and look for the new one coming soon. All right, let's get to the Netherlands. Near Amsterdam, I think, is where Catherine Austin Fitz is today. So let's connect with her. Catherine, nice to have you back on the show.
Oh, Howard, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. It's always great to talk to you.
And it's always good to catch up with you. Now, you're in Europe at the moment, in the Netherlands. Uh-huh. I said you were in Amsterdam. I don't think you're quite in Amsterdam, are you?
No, I'm a couple hours north.
Okay. I've been to Hilversum in Amsterdam, and it's absolutely beautiful. But uh-huh. I've never explored the rest of Holland. I really should.
Oh, it's fabulous. I love Friesland. Friesland is the live free or die part.
And are you coping with the time difference?
Oh, not a problem. Not a problem. I have my international meeting planner, and, you know, I regularly have to work with five or six different time zones within a day. So this is standard operating procedure at Solari.
Now, I've described you in the intro to this, because it's always very hard to describe you. You've done so many things. But I've basically said that you were at the nexus of finance and government, where those things coalesce. I mean, you've done some very, very important jobs, but now you're doing something very different. You're analyzing them. You're explaining them to people. Why did you make that move?
Well, I was involved. I always tell people, have you seen the movie Enemy of the State? I played Will Smith in real life. I was I had a very successful investment bank in Washington, the Hamilton Securities Group, and ended up in serious litigation with the Department of Justice, where I had, you know, it's very funny because when you're watching the news, you see it happen. I had multiple attempts to falsify evidence and frame me. I had physical harassment. I had smear campaigns. It was very immersive. And in the process, I realized if I was going to stay alive, I had to tell my story. I had terrible experiences in the Bush administration with the New York Times, and then an even worse one with the Washington Post during the litigation. And I said, you know, that's it. I'm never talking to corporate media again. You know, we didn't have the expression fake news, but they were really engaged in criminality. They were engaged in sort of targeting and destroying people, you know, in highly political ways that were just, you know, it was making news up out of whole cloth. Anyway, so I said, I'm never talking to corporate media again. And I started to do radio shows, and I said, I'm just going to answer people's questions. And I kept getting more and more questions and more and more questions. And after we won the litigation, I decided I would start an investment advisory company, because a lot of the questions were, how do I protect my savings mm-hmm. from the corruption? And then I started the investment advisory, and a process began where 50 clients would ask me the same question every week. And I said, I cannot answer, you know, sort of what's in the budget 50 times in 1 week. So I said, I'm going to have to do a podcast, and that way I can answer the question once and then everybody can listen to it. And so when I started to do that for the clients, we said, well, let's take subscriptions. And that was the Solaria Report. Mm-hmm. And Howard, if you had told me that I would be running a media company, I would have said that was the two things I would never, ever do. Was I would never do investment advisory, and I would never do media. Those are the two things I would never do.
And you're doing both.
And now I do them. Now I'm doing them. And when I tell you, you had to drag me kicking and screaming. It was just, I'll never forget when I got back to I lived in Hong Kong to study Chinese in college. And I came back and I got a job as a waitress. And I'll never forget walking out of the kitchen, and there was a table of four sophisticated, attractive, you know, two couples. And I thought, I can't just walk up to that table and talk to complete strangers. And I turned around and started to walk back in the kitchen. I said, wait a minute, if I don't talk to them, I'll starve. So
it's a great motivator, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. I said, okay, well, I guess I can talk to them. So it was basically the market wanted me to be in media and to be an investment advisor. And so that's what I became. But you know, go figure. It's, you know, I just have to tell you, it's a whole new experience for me. And now I enjoy it because, you know, it's funny. I was talking to a very famous politician in Washington about 2 months ago, and we were standing in the middle of Union Station, and one of the senators came through and walked by us, and they started to talk and say hello. And then my friend introduced me to him, and he said, what do you do? And I said, well, I publish the Solaria Report. He said, what's that? And I said, well, I have this fabulous group of people who pay me to travel around the world and talk about what I want and look at and research what I want and interview whoever I want, you know, and tell them what I think. And he looked at me and he said, how do I get that job? And I said, well, the apprenticeship is a little rough.
Well, yeah, you've got to go through a certain amount to get to the sunlit uplands, I think. But no, look, it is a great position that you're in, because there is nothing like freedom. I have freedom on my podcast, but you have complete freedom. But just to wind you back very slightly to the beginning of this, because it's very pertinent to this modern world of ours with Mr. Trump in office, you said that you were the target when you were involved in your litigation of the mainstream media, which was in a way, if I'm not reading too much into what you said, deployed against you.
Well, I think they were just following along. I think it was the intelligence agency. It was Department of Justice and CIA, is my guess. It was very funny. There was a great story when in the middle of this, you know, it's very immersive because you got people doing surveillance and following you 24 hours a day, and you got, you know, all sorts of lies in the newspaper. But I was asked during that period to go on the board of a little think tank in Washington that does a lot of work for the military. And I walked in, and the former head of the CIA was on the board. He just left the CIA, and he was flipping a pen. And the chairman of the board said to me, he said, oh, you know, welcome. And the guy from the CIA freaked out, and his pen flew up and hit the ceiling. And he looked at me like I was going to punch him. And that's when I realized, oh, you know, I'm right. The CIA is the problem.
And did you say to him, I think we've met before? Even if you hadn't, you had in a way.
No, I said to him, I said, James, it's so good to see you. How are you? You know, because they never think they're going to have to face you. The boy, you know, he figured I'd be in prison. He didn't think he'd have to face me at a board meeting.
You see, you call it immersive. I would call it terrifying.
No, it's, you know, there are many things in this life that are terrifying. And getting on the wrong side at the Department of Justice and the CIA is life-threatening, but it's not terrifying. What's terrifying is waking up and being their slave and having to do everything they say. That's terrifying.
Sign of the times, but then I think the sign of every time. It's not just a recent phenomenon, all of those things. Now, I want to take you on a little journey here.
Okay.
Because of something that's appeared in the newspapers here in Europe, and I guess it's appeared in North America too. Paul Hellyer, former Canadian Defence Minister, a man I've interviewed before because he basically believes in ETs and UFOs and believes he's seen the evidence, believes that there are questions to be answered. He's recently given a talk which made the papers here, and I've got the Daily Express version of it from the UK. Uh-huh. He basically says, the headline says, that Mr. Hellyer, former Canadian Defence Minister, Paul is in his 80s now, as you know, says that the Illuminati exists. He says, you have a secret cabal that's actually running the world, and they've managed to keep this technology, technology that could solve all sorts of problems, under wraps until they cash in the trillions of oil assets that they've got. He said, corrupt, hidden leaders continue to wage needless wars and focus on profits rather than stopping climate change. So that was one thing he was talking about. He was saying that the technology to stop climate change exists. I think I'm inferring this correctly. And we're not using it. It's not a story that we haven't heard before. I don't know whether you've heard his remarks, but do they surprise you in any way?
Well, it's clear that the use of fossil fuel, which is a very old legacy technology, is a political decision. So if you believe that climate change results from the use of fossil fuel, which I don't believe that, but if you do believe it, then we could have moved off of fossil fuel at a minimum when Tesla gave us a way to do it. So, we have made a political choice to use fossil fuel, and we could have moved off of it, you know, more than a century ago at a minimum. So I think there's a big question mark there. Why are we using fossil fuel if it's so, you know, bad for the environment?
Well, there's a why, and if we listen to what Mr. Hellyer said and others over the years, there's a who there. Because if you believe there's a new world order, an Illuminati, a group of people who are the puppet masters pulling the strings and we can't see them, then there is something at play here that perhaps the public needs to know about.
Well, the governance structure on planet Earth is invisible. It's a mystery. And that's the question, who's really in charge and why are they behaving this way? So it's clear that we have, you know, if you look at whoever is in charge here, it's clear that they look at you and me as though we are a different species and they lack empathy for our species. So whether it's, some people posit it's crypto-terrestrials, a separate species that is co-located on Earth. Some people say, okay, it's alien. I will tell you from a financial standpoint, we're clearly paying a dividend somewhere. You know, we have a dividend disappearing. And the question is, you know, is it going down into the middle of the Earth or is it going up to the, you know, where is it going? So clearly there is a species that may or may not be our species, but looks at us as if we are another species. And the question is, who are they? Why are they behaving this way? You know, what is interdimensional? What is off planet? What is a separate species co-located in this planet? And to tell you the truth, I don't know. I've always worked with probabilities. And what I've said is it is absurd that we should live on a planet where the governance structure is a mystery. Mm. It's crazy. And you know, that gets into the fact that a great deal of money and time goes into financial systems and mind control used to manipulate us, and it's an enormous waste of energy. So I see this as being a planet that is a result of this secret governance system is exceptionally primitive in how it operates and how it's managed. And there's no doubt, you know, one of the key tools is to use warfare and divide and conquer to harvest us financially.
And do you believe that there is an organization, a structure, an Illuminati, or is it more random than that?
Well, here's my experience. My experience is that everything in this world, you know, the people who run the world, to the extent that I dealt with them, they're planners. They have a 100-year plan, a 50-year plan, and, you know, everything's planned. They have goals and plan, and, you know, so nothing, things don't happen by coincidence, don't action. But at the same time, it's a very big planet, so there is a lot of cooperation and competition. But it certainly felt and seemed to me like it was highly centralized through the investment, the management of pools of capital and investment. And it gets back to this question of, are we required to, you know, is Planet Earth a subsidiary of a much bigger corporation, and are we required to sort of make our franchise fee or dividend every year? Because that would explain a lot. But I saw a lot of cooperation and competition. I never heard the word Illuminati until I started speaking publicly, and then, you know, people would say there's this thing called the Illuminati. I never ran into one Illuminati. All I ran into was a lot of different power groups that competed and cooperated.
So what we have here in the UK is a thing they used to call the Old Boys Network. I'm sure you've come across that phrase when you've been here. The Old Boys Network is all the people who've been to the same public schools and have the same social experiences, all helping each other behind the scenes. What you're describing is something much more organized than that.
Well, if you look at them in the United States, and I think it's true in the UK too, every place is very tightly organized by the Masons. So you have a place, and also the Vatican, the church. So you have place-based organizations that very tightly control and manage places. And it's interesting, one of my experiences as a young child with the Masons was, you know, everybody get to the lodge on Wednesday and talk cross-sector. So they would manage the economy because the university guys and the bankers and the lawyers and the politicians and the guys who ran the ports. And, you know, there was one of every sector, and they talked about the whole economy, the local economy as a financial ecosystem, and it was very integrated. Then you'd walk outside of the Freemasons, and everything was like, no, you're in your box over here at the university, or you're in your box over here at the ports. And people couldn't possibly come up with the kind of plan you're connoting, because, you know, that would require cross-sector integration and coordination, and that's a conspiracy, and that would never happen. So place-based economic and financial knowledge and data was how they controlled. You know, their ability to integrate and operate cross-sector was their great, at great speeds, was their control tactic. So, and it worked, because everybody else was kind of in their little expert box and couldn't see the whole picture. When I first came out and started to do the Solari report, Howard, I was amazed, because I started to work with researchers and reporters, and I was stunned at how little they understood about money, let alone how money works within a place. And it's quite amazing, the absence of sort of economic and financial literacy in the population. And that's what I've been trying to do with the Solari report, is really give people the kind of actionable intelligence they need to understand those things.
I mean, the Freemasons is a discussion that we can have another time, I think. They are currently running a publicity campaign here, and I had somebody on a radio show that I did explaining that, you know, they're a fraternal group and they do a lot of charity work, and that's just it. I guess any organization where people meet is a place where people can cooperate as well as meet.
Well, but here's the thing. From what I've seen of the Freemasons, they do an awful lot of good, and if there's order in places in the United States, a lot of it was created and managed by either the church, the Vatican and the church and the Freemasons. But unfortunately, they also make it their business to organize and manage the organized crime too. So, you know, so there's a covert side and there's an overt side. On the overt side, I would argue that they do a tremendous amount of good.
Right. Okay. Well, that is another debate for another place and another time. Recently, we had a lot of market turbulence. We had 2 weeks ago the markets in the U.S. dropping after record growth under Donald Trump. You know, he's saying, look what I've done for the economy. Stocks began to dip. That was echoed, of course, across the Atlantic. It always is. And then I think things began to correct themselves. But I did begin to wonder what exactly is happening. Has somebody decided that a switch has to be pulled now and there's got to be a big sell-off and we've got to take the economy into a bit of a dive for reasons that us ordinary punters don't understand? What do you think was going on?
I don't know. You know, we are so overdue. If you look at the history of the equity markets and how often during a normal bull market you have a correction, we were so overdue for a major correction that it was abnormal. You know, what every investor wants is what I call the stairway to heaven. They want it to go up 0.5% every day forever.
You know, that would be nice.
Right. But, you know, I hate to say it, coming out of 2009, that's what it's behaved like. You know, I'm grossly exaggerating. And we are seriously overdue for a major correction. It's perfectly healthy and natural. So now there are many things that could have caused it, et cetera, et cetera. And there's no doubt that the equity, particularly the U.S. equity market, which is one way ahead of the emerging markets in Europe, is very, you know, richly valued. But I for one, you know, everything, every sign I see says we're in a long-term bull market and we're in for a 10 to 20% correction, and it's way overdue. So my attitude is it would be healthy.
Okay. Correction is a nice word. Slump or downturn is a difficult word, but I know that's a different thing in terms of definitions. The problem is, isn't it, when there's any downturn or when things go down a bit, it is always the ordinary people who tend to suffer. Others above me and above you have made provision.
Right. So one of the provisions, I have a tremendous number of my clients in what's called hedged equity. So the hedges, you know, if the market drops, the hedges help to offset that drop. You know, there are many provisions you can take to protect it, or you can just be, you know, buy and hold. So if you were buy and hold coming out of 2009, you went up, you went up over 100%, and now you're going to give back 10 to 20% of correction. Here's the frustrating thing for the average investor. The question is, you're not going to know, let's say I'm wrong, that the bull market's over and it's going to turn to a bear market. You're not going to know that's true until it's down 25%. So you won't know, oh, it's no longer a bull, we're in a bear, unless it goes down 25% or more. And nobody likes to give up 25% of their portfolio value, you know, waiting to see if it's a bear. So so that's the challenge here, and that's what happens when you get these kind of huge run-ups. I will say this. If you look, because I'm just in the process of finishing our big write-up on pension funds, mm-hmm. which will have the PDF and hard copy in about 2 or 3 weeks. If you look at what is happening in the system, so many people, Howard, do not trust the system because we've seen so much corruption and so much bad behavior. I mean, basically, I got into investment advisory over, you know, against my kicking and screaming because people wanted someone who understood the fraud and the corruption. And what I have to tell you is it's just mind-boggling to have to deal every day with the corruption and the fraud in the governance system and in the financial system. And it's a, you know, I think a lot of investors are saying, look, I don't, you know, I just don't want to participate in it because I've had it with the, you know, with the bad behavior. And I've also had it with putting my money in funds that are financing all these different things that are killing me and my kids. So I just am not going to participate. And I'm sympathetic with that. And to me, this is a major question for what I call the Anglo-American Alliance, because our claim to fame has been financial markets and financial liquidity. And at this point, I think we're killing the goose that laid the golden egg.
Well, if people start to lose confidence in them, I mean, I'm speaking to you from London. London is based on the finance markets. You've only got to go into the city, look at the Shard and all the wonderful buildings there. Right. You know how successful it all is and how well people are doing. That will destabilize it if people lose confidence. And the other thing that will destabilize it is if one of the effects of Brexit, if that happens, and that's now being debated at the moment, will be that some financial institutions will move themselves to Frankfurt or Paris or somewhere else.
Well, but I have news for you. I was very impressed with Britain's decision on Brexit, and I'm of the school that it, you know, that part of the impetus to do that came from the royal family, because I think, really? You know, at the heart of, believe it or not, at the heart of financial liquidity, it has to operate on a base of culture. You can't depend on just the formal law. You have to have a culture that believes in integrity and transactions and practices, all sorts of things. And to me, Brexit first and foremost was a decision about, are we going to have a British culture and are we going to be able to preserve that British culture? And I think it was the right decision, and I was very impressed at the way that Britain made it. I know implementing it is a nightmare, but to me, if you're going to be great at financial markets and financial liquidity, you cannot allow immigration and what was happening to destroy your culture.
Well, leaving aside all of that, because that was at the core of it, if you can leave it aside, there was the nature of the campaign. And I'm talking about both sides, some very shabby, very unfinished, very poor, and right. Downright misleading arguments were used on both sides. And, you know, right. Those misleading arguments are coming back to haunt both sides now. The British people, I think, are in absolute confusion about this. And if the British people are in confusion, you want to look at our government as well, because they are riven with splits about this. So it's going to be a very difficult and rocky process that we're going into. And there is the definite feeling, and I express no views on Brexit here. I'm not going to. I'm just going to watch it. But there is the definite feeling that there are forces beyond all of us that want a different outcome, that want us not to Brexit, and are determined to get us to perhaps have another referendum, or are determined to make it so that this just does not happen in the form that people who voted for this, if they understood the arguments and if those arguments were sound in the first place, in the way that they want it and sanctioned. So there seems to be something happening behind the scenes, and it seems to me that levers, as you say in America, are being pulled by someone to try and change the outcome.
Well, what the problem you have in Britain is the same problem we have in the United States, which is the same problem you're watching all around the world. It's what I call the Midianite thing. Are you familiar with the story of Gideon in the Bible?
Oh, yes.
Okay, so Gideon comes down. Gideon is approached by an angel of the Lord and says, "We want you to throw the Midianites out of Israel." And to make a long story short, Gideon and his army of 300 come down the sides of the mountain banging lanterns and pitchers. And the Midianites are so hateful and suspicious that they jump up in the dark and kill each other. And if you look at what's going on in the United States and what it looks like in Britain is you have the establishment at war with each other. Part of it is that we've had what I call the financial coup, in which we bubbled the economy and everybody was fat and happy. And now if you look at the people you need to steal money during a financial coup, you don't need them anymore. So they're being purged, re-engineered, changed. And meantime, the money is shrinking for, those kinds of people, and they're at each other's throats. So I see some real debate and fighting within the establishment as to which direction things are going to go.
It is a very, I've never known a time of turbulence like this one in my lifetime in this country. A lot of people voted, as you said, on the immigration issue. That was a one issue for them to make their decision. But there is the counter argument that our economy has always been enriched by incomers. So has yours in the US.
Right.
They have made us what we are. So we can't go closing the door on talented people. But there was a view before all of this happened that we were letting in a lot of people who perhaps were not qualified in any particular way, were not really adding to the economy, and were just, coming to ride our improved conditions here. I don't know. I mean, it's not stuff that I want to get into, but these were the things that we were all hearing.
Right. Well, I think, to me, if you're a place, whether it's a nation or a community, you need to be able to manage, have some control of who's allowed in and who's allowed out. So there needs to be a law or a plan, and you need to abide by it. Otherwise, you've got chaos.
And therein lies the issue, because at the core of the European project is free movement of labor. The fact that I have the freedom at this moment, if I decide to up sticks now, pack all my gear up, go and live on the Costa del Sol or go and live in Paris, I can do it freely. Whether I will be able to do that in a couple of years from now, I'm not entirely sure.
Here's what I would really encourage you and your listeners to do. I always try and get my subscribers to watch a video of Sir James Goldsmith in 1994. He came to the United States to try and persuade Congress not to pass the Uruguay Round of GATT. And in it, he talked about what we were doing globally to industrialize agriculture that was going to unleash migration of, billions of people and could destroy many different areas. It's one of the most prescient intelligence comments on the global economy. And I would, if you do come to Solari and do a search on Sir James Goldsmith, it was an interview with Charlie Rose, and he's basically describing what's going on in the global economy in a way that gives you very important context. Because the problem is not that we have sort of out of control immigration. The problem is that we're destroying the homelands of people all around the world.
How so?
When you take an economy where, 50, 60, 70% of the people are small farmers, and you introduce GMO seed and you try and industrialize agriculture and you throw them all off the land and they move into the cities, you create an economic and physical tsunami the likes of which is hard to even understand what could happen. Mm-hmm. Not to mention when you go in and destroy, Libya was the wealthiest, most successful country in Africa. You destroy Libya and you uncork Africa in terms of unprecedented migration coming into Europe. So, when you run around destroying countries, whether it's destroying the agricultural industry, or you do what we did in Libya, then you're going to get these wild flood of immigrants.
I don't think that's is up for debate, is it really? That's what's happened. That's how history has unfolded. I mean, in many ways, these issues are also RANs when you consider the big things that are happening that never get talked about. For example, we have an aging population everywhere because of our health standards. We've taken a bit of a falter recently. I think the life expectancy is not quite as good as it was now because of the junk food that people are eating. But nevertheless, people are living longer, they're healthier. But also they're poorer. Everyone's poorer. I'm poorer. It is a tremendous worry, and politicians don't seem to want to confront what is maybe only 20 years away.
Well, and here's why. I go back to what I call the financial coup d'etat. A decision was made at the beginning of the 90s to bubble the G7 economies and shift a great deal of capital out. In the United States, it was by illegal means. So we shifted out 20-plus trillion with the bailouts. There's $21 trillion missing from federal accounts.
And when you say bubble, just for those who are not financially inclined, do you mean to create an artificial boom?
Yes. So we poured mortgage credit into the mortgage markets and boomed the housing markets, both in the United States and globally. And that created a lot of activity and a sense of wellness. And so as you shifted capital, I'll give you an example. In 1997, I was making a presentation to a board of top pension fund leaders in the country. And I was talking about how we could re-engineer government investments in communities to dramatically improve productivity and make a lot of money for the pension funds. It would have been a great investment for them. And the head of the largest pension fund in the country looked at me and he said, "You don't understand. They've given up on the country. They're moving all the money out starting in the fall." And that's when the securities fraud in the mortgage market started really growing dramatically, and it's when the money started to go missing. I'm always writing about $21 trillion that's gone missing from HUD and DOD. That's when the money started to go missing. So I think there was a concerted decision to globalize capital. Now, what did that do? The net effect, and this is why I'm writing the pension fund analysis we're publishing in a couple of weeks, a decision was basically made, look, let's take our capital and move it out of the pension funds and retirement systems, reinvest it in a variety of ways, including globalization, before everybody retires. In other words, do we want to have a space program or do we want to pay for nursing homes? And a decision was made to basically engineer a major shift of capital so that when the time came for the boomers to retire, a lot of the money would be essentially gone because it would be replaced with IOUs, from governments that were now leveraged up, or the currency would be debased, or a variety of other things. So I'll give you an example, because the UK looks much better than we do on this. If you look at the average annual return of the pension funds from 2007 to 2016, the average annual return, I think, of the UK pension funds is 7%. The US is 2.2%.
That's astonishing.
Isn't that astonishing? So it's more, those are non-conforming numbers, so you have to dig in and look deeply. But, many, many things have happened, I believe, to result in the pension funds being underfunded where they would be if they were run properly in this sort of financial coup shift hadn't happened. So remember, here's the problem, Howard. The pension funds were created after World War II as a way to control and concentrate capital. So before then, most families controlled their capital. If I'm a family, I have my savings and I control where it goes and what's invested in. When you engineer things into a pension fund system, then you get central control of where that money goes. Now, we built the multinational juggernaut based on this enormous flow of money into the pensions. There are now in the U.S. and funded pensions, you know, more than $25 trillion. And that capital was what really built the multinational juggernaut. Now, the baby boomers have been putting in a dollar every year. The problem is suddenly they want a dollar back, and that's a $2 problem because the multinational juggernaut needs the dollar to keep coming, if you will. And so I think what happened is the leadership looked down the road and said, you know, we need to come up with a way of being able to be capital rich through this transition and not let all of society's capital go into nursing homes.
Dear Lord. So this means that there is a crisis coming down the track, but no one's talking about it.
No, there's no. Well, that's not true. I'm not no one, and I'm talking about it. You can come read our pension funds. I just published the transcript for the audio that I gave on the pension fund. But let me give you the numbers. If you look at the underfunding of the U.S. pension funds, it's probably at this point about $5 trillion. Now, that is only 10% of the $50 trillion that got shifted on the financial coup d'etat. So when the banks got in trouble, we had no problem coming up with $20-plus trillion for the banks, even though we had no legal obligation to do so. So, and there's $21 trillion missing from the federal government, even though there's no legal train tracks to take that money missing. But all told, that's $50 trillion. 10% of that is 5%. So I would say the pension fund underfunding is relatively small in the scheme of things. So, you know, is it a problem? No, it's a plan.
Yeah, but it's a plan for who? It's not benefiting the people who've been putting their dollar in, like me.
Well, actually, if you look at the returns you've been getting in the UK, you probably have done pretty well.
All right, so, with my 7%, yes, I take your point.
My compliments to the UK pension board or whoever's doing it. But anyway, here's the thing. I think it comes back to where we started, which is the governance system is invisible and it does not have integrity. And that includes the management of our retirement capital. The process by which we're managing retirement capital clearly lacks integrity, and it's part of the governance system lacking integrity. And so, you know, and right now the average Brit or the average American is saying, I don't want to put my money in the system because I don't trust it, because it doesn't have integrity. And the question is, how are we going to resolve that? Right now, the establishment is not helping us resolve that. They're just fighting each other, trying to figure out how to keep it all secret.
So the dynamic at work here is that not only is the pension system a little weaker, but not perhaps as weak as I might have thought it was, but people are at the same time losing confidence in the system, and that is going to chip it away a little more.
So here's if you look at the numbers, and again, the data is non-conforming, so take it with a grain of salt. You know, the Americans have 4% of the people, and they have something like 30% of the pension fund savings. China has 18% of the people and 1% of the pension fund savings. And if you look at the total numbers, we're totally, completely blessed. Now, you'll read these articles, Howard, that scare you to death about how we are underfunded. The big underfunding is not on the pension funds. We do have an underfunding. The big underfunding is on healthcare, because I have news for you. If you eat poison and if you breathe poison, you will end up with 30 years of chronic diseases, and there's not enough money in the world to pay for all the healthcare you need, especially if the healthcare is just drugging you and poisoning you more. Do you see what I mean?
I do. It's a very scary outlook, but yes, I do.
Well, but here's the solution to the healthcare situation is to re-engineer nutrition. You know, it's a fundamental re-engineering whereby we get the agriculture and healthcare to an economic basis, as opposed to subsidizing the stock market. I mean, right now the U.S. economy is engineering everything to increase corporate profits, even if that corporation is destructive to the economy. You need a win-win relationship between companies and the economy. And right now, increasingly, we have a win-lose relationship. You know, the sicker people get, the more the pharmaceutical companies make, and around we go. So you're going to have to get the win. You're going to have to re-engineer, and this gets back to the governance system. You're going to have to re-engineer the governance system so that it re-engineers the financial system and the corporate system to be win-win to each other. Now, here's what's interesting. Given what we have with new technology, the wealth potential, Howard, is so explosive of what's possible. And the question is, how do we get in a position where we can take advantage of that? You know, there seems to be two pathways. One is a lease get together, husband the technology, and then liquidate everybody. You know, feed everybody GMO, and they become infertile, and we all die, so you depopulate. But the other is, you know, we use democracy and markets and integrate this new technology and grow up. We shift from a primitive society to an advanced civilization, but a human civilization. That's what I would love.
We've got an awful lot to do then. If you think about the process, I mean, you know, it's almost too much because, you know, us ordinary people don't have a lot of control. But if you think about it, what you've said means that we have to... Sorry,
I have a lot of control of my life, so... What you and I can do is you and I can do it in our own lives. Just do it. In other words, we don't need to wait for the governors to do it. We just do it. If everyone, you know, there's 7 billion people on this planet, and what's going to happen is what we choose to do. Are we going to choose to be human and interact with other humans in a human way or not? So if you come into Solari, I have a little silver coin, and on one side of the coin it says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. I mean, I have news for you. All the evil on this planet is being implemented, you know, by normal people. All we have to do is stop. That was the fight I had in Washington. The reason the Department of Justice came after me was, you know, I was consistently ordered as a contractor during the Clinton administration to do things that were against, you know, outside the law or would hurt people, and I refused to do it.
But you were very much in the minority. You know the structure of organizations and their psychology is that the organization is bigger than the individual, and it's very hard to be one person who wants to swim against the tide. I've been there in big organizations. You don't do it.
You know something? If we want to build a human society, there are no excuses. You've got to be a human. So... you know, the question for me was, I'm not going to make money on genocide. I'm not going to participate. Because if you look at what the Clinton administration was doing, our company was lead financial advisor to HUD, and one of the deputy assistant secretaries said to me, look, black people are hopeless. We're going to move them out and move Hispanics in. And I said, that's ridiculous. Black people aren't hopeless. And, you know, you can't do that. That's genocide.
Well, that's a staggeringly racist comment for a start.
Right. Well, they were rounding them up and stuffing them into private prisons. Everybody's making money on the private prison stocks. I have an online book. If you go to dylanreedandco.com, it's called Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, and I've written up the whole thing and told the tale. But you were dropping SWAT teams, Department of Justice SWAT teams, into poor neighborhoods, rounding up innocent kids, pulling the money on the public defender's office and stuffing them into private prison companies where they made money making uniforms for the Department of Justice had a for-profit company that was marketing their labor to government agencies, including the Department of Defense. So it's
and,
no
and
different.
And you say that was an active plan.
I've written a document. Go to dylanreedandco.com, 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 or just do a search for Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits. I've written and documented all of it. There are thousands of pages of legal documents and SEC financial filings. It's documented up the wazoo. And I just said, look, you know, I'm not going along with this, because if you can genocide innocent kids or round them up and put them in slave labor camps, we know where that goes. We know where it went the last time. I'm not participating. So, you know, and I'm arrogant enough to think that I can find a way to support myself, you know, doing something that will help other people, that will legitimately be productive. You know, it doesn't have to be big. It just has to be enough to, you know, pay the rent and cover the food bill. So, you know, and that's what I did. I said, no, I'm not doing this and I'm not going along. It's not okay. And all you need is a critical mass. You don't need everybody. 5 to 10% saying, you know, we can find a human pathway, because the problem with the economy, Howard, at this point is you have so much financial fraud and money laundering and organized crime that it's crowding out the productive. And that's why productivity is falling. We have a great Salieri report on the problem with productivity, but the productivity rates are falling. And the reason they're falling is no one can take this much secrecy, this much lying, this much fake news, this much fake science. You know what I mean? The average person, I call it shadow work, is buried by dealing and struggling with an incredible load of, you know, both complexity and corruption.
And I thought productivity levels were falling because companies and organizations were not investing in the human capital, the people, and not investing in machinery and technology as they should be.
That's part of it. So part of it is how they're investing their money. But the other part of it is a lot of the productivity increases within companies come at the expense of destroying productivity in the general population.
Right. By some of the products that are produced that are not of the standard to sustain people.
Well, in the United States, a woman my age who does not have a high school degree, since 1990, her life expectancy has dropped 5 years.
And as ordinary people, you talk about the power of the people, and I love the sound of this, but I wonder how it might happen. If you think about it, how can we as ordinary people make farmers grow better crops and, you know, go back to the soil properly? And how can we make the big food manufacturers stop putting garbage in the stuff that the supermarkets sell?
So here's the key. The key to life is time. You only have so much time, and your time is precious. Mm-hmm. So what I tell everybody to sit down, I always have my clients do a time budget before they do a money budget. I said, sit down and look at your time. Who and what is draining your time? Where are you losing time in a way that doesn't give you energy? So let's say you can cut out 5 hours of TV. Oh, you know, I definitely try and get people to turn off their TV. So find 5 hours. Okay, now use that 5 hours to change your bank from a bank who doesn't care about you to a really great local financially secure bank or credit union that does care about you. Okay, then once you get that done, take that 5 hours and use it to organize with your neighbors to maybe go down to the terminal market and buy wholesale organic fresh food, you know, and so you can afford to eat healthy, or learn how to, you know, how to improve your nutrition and your diet and everything else, and keep taking that 5 hours every week to change, you know, go through your financial statement and your income statement and your balance sheet and start to significantly improve the energy you're getting by moving to trustworthy systems. Is your bank trustworthy? Is your farmer or farmer's markets trustworthy? Are the restaurants you eat at it trustworthy? Are the people you're associating with trustworthy? Go through your whole thing and stop giving your money. You know, you have a tapeworm. Stop feeding the tapeworm. In other words, detox the tapeworm out of your life. Get the dirty money and the dirty institutions and the dirty players out of your money. I mean, you know, if you have your email on Google, you know, if you're on Facebook, what's your problem? Of course you're being drained. You know, you're being surveillanced, and you're basically feeding surveillance capitalism predators.
But the problem is to communicate and to be seen to be like other people and to not isolate yourself completely. You have to do those things. I mean, increasingly, I find there's a gravitational pull to forcing me to have Google Mail, and, you know, you've got to be on Facebook.
No, you don't. I made the mistake. I had some of my subscribers persuade me a couple of years ago, please, please, please get on Facebook. I got on Facebook as soon as I hit, you know, 1,500 people on my Facebook, whatever, they hacked me. And I said, I'm not gonna be a honey trap for Facebook. So I'm off. I've never been on Facebook. And it's interesting, after the election was over here, the YouTube and Google and Facebook, all these things sort of pruned independent media. And I had one guy say, you know, you're the only person in independent media whose revenues haven't gone down. We, you know, we've all experienced 50 to 90% drops in revenues. And I said, because you depended on those guys. I mean, you do not want to build your business around people who have no integrity.
Well, look, what I do on this podcast is completely independent. And people laugh at me all the time. They say, you have no social media presence. And I don't. You know, I've got to get one, I guess, if I want to be in step with everybody else. But I have done this completely independently.
I do Twitter. So, and I like Twitter. I think Twitter, you know, it's not perfect, but some very good things have happened on Twitter. And there's a lot of truth bouncing around on Twitter. But I, you know, no, I think you have to grow your business. To me, the number one thing, I had a hissy fit about 5 years ago, Howard, because I had a just sort of one more problem with somebody acting out of integrity. And I sat back and I came back and said to my team, all I care about is integrity. So we are going to take this down to however small we have to be. We are only going to work with and have people who have integrity. That's all I care. I don't care how fast we grow. I don't care how big we grow. All I care about is integrity. And we completely re-engineered what we did and how we did. And, you know, life got really pleasant because you're not constantly being hiccuped by, you know, people who just, or people or institutions or organizations that don't have integrity. Now, we have plenty of problems. You know, I spend an awful lot of money dealing with hacks and, you know, all the different problems that everybody in independent media does. But, you know, day to day, everybody I work with has very high integrity, and it's wonderful.
So it all starts with the individual. And the first thing you have to do, and I don't know how I would do that here, but there must be a way, is find a bank that's not one of the big corporates that has maybe better ethical standards. You say that is where it all begins.
Right. So I bank at the, and everybody's different. Your neighborhood, your situation is different. And I tell people, don't change right away if you're really embroiled in a bank. You know, get a new bank, make sure you like it, make sure you're comfortable, and then migrate over time. I've got if you do a search for Solari Bank Local, I've got a whole section on how to identify a good local bank or credit union. Anyway, but I bank at the world's most wonderful community bank. I absolutely love them. They're so, I mean, they're just, you know, their business is, they're not in the derivatives business. They're not in the financial front. They're just in the business of helping, you know, their customers. And it's really amazing. I was in Italy last year, and I got hit with fraud charges on my bank card.
Really?
And I'm walking through the middle of Verona having a blast, and I get a call within 20 minutes of getting hit by this charge from my community banker and said, you just got hit by a 500 charge at Paris Disney World. We know that's not you.
Well, they're doing their job then.
I was in Verona to see Beethoven. They knew I was not at Disney World. So he got it in 20 minutes. I said, cancel the card. And I hung up and I thought, you know, that's what it means to have a real relationship with your banker. Now, I've banked with them for many years and have a lot of personal, it's an old, the people who run it are my family. It's been in the family for generations. And, you know, so I've made a real effort to go get to know them and build a relationship. But it's so wonderful to have a bank you can completely, utterly trust. It's just a great feeling.
So part of it is bottom up. That's us taking decisions like that. And that's going to be difficult for a lot of people. I mean, look, I'm in a leafy part of London. It's still pretty busy. But 10 miles down the road from here, it's ridiculous. People are living manic lives. But part of it is bottom up, as you say. But part of it has to be, doesn't it? Top down. We have to make the banks and the organizations producing our food and pharmaceuticals and other things behave better.
Well, you know how you behave better when they see all the customer leave. Here's the thing. The corruption is not at the top. It's funny, we just published something called Control 101, where I describe how the control system on planet Earth works. And I started it off by telling a story of Richard Dolan and I talking about false flags. He had done his wonderful series on false flags. And he came into a luncheon I was giving, and I said, Richard, how are you? And he said, actually, I'm a little bit shaken. I said, why is that? He said, you know, this research has really shaken me when you understand false flags and how they're used. And he said, I don't know how to describe how I feel. And I said, I know exactly how you feel, Richard. You feel like a chicken who's finally envisioned what it looks like to think and be the farmer. And he looked at me and he said, yes, that's it. So here's my news about control on planet Earth. There's a farmer, there's us chickens, and then there's something called livestock management. And the way the farmer runs it is that most of the control is implemented by the chickens.
Hmm.
And the day the chickens decide, you know something? You know, we're not going to play. We're going to see the thing whole. We're going to see it from the farmer's point of view, and we're going to turn it. And it doesn't take everybody. It takes 5%.
As little as 5%.
Yep. Right, of which you're one and I'm one. All it takes is enough people saying, you know, no, we're not doing this. And that's why, you know, the Trump campaign was such a big event in the United States, because what Trump did was he made it possible. He put a crack in the wall of talking about reality. You know, so he brought up Common Core, he brought up vaccines. He called CNN fake news, which he clearly is. He, you know, in other words, he started to have a conversation about reality. And that, you know, America was in a state of complete Orwellian dysfunction where nobody could talk about reality.
So and you're telling me that Donald Trump is a really good thing?
Well, I'm telling you...
I have no views, by the way, before people start emailing me saying, what are you saying about our president? I'm not getting anywhere.
Here was the debate that America faced. The model that was being used was going to destroy America. And America, I'll use myself. There was, if you elected Clinton, America was going to fail. There was 100% chance, and there was... You know, it was hopelessness. Donald Trump, the last thing you need to do is make, you know, the presidency of the United States is not an entry-level position. So to put somebody in that position who has no knowledge of how to run, you know, a state or municipal government, let alone the federal government, you know, it's a horrible thing to do. The reality is there was some hope. And at least what would start to come out of it was a conversation. And part of it would deliver a message to the establishment. We would rather destroy the country than have another 4 years of you.
Mm. That's interesting.
And so,
I mean, it's not a debate I necessarily want to get into. And every time I veer towards American politics, I get emails from people telling me, how dare I here on this side of the Atlantic even entertain these debates and discussions? So I'm always wary now of those emails that come in. I just think that
if you look at the U.S. budget, mm-hmm, and U.S. federal credit, that pot of money and credit is whipping the U.K. back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. So you absolutely... A UK citizen has a lot of vested interest in making sure, you know, if the federal finances in the United States could be returned to the rule of law, it would make an enormous difference for the UK.
Yeah. And when America sneezes, they say, and I've always said through my life, you know, we catch a cold. And that's just the truth of it. And, you know, no matter how the relationship has ebbed and flowed, that's always going to be so. Talk to me, if you will, about robots and robotics. Robotics and robots and quantum computing are things at the moment that we are being sold on. It's like everything in this world. We're being told it's a good thing and we've got to have it. Are those things going to be good for us? It seems to me they're going to put an awful lot of people out of work and make even more money for the people who've already got it.
Well, it's going to facilitate more central control. And you're right, it's going to put a lot of people out of work. Now, robotics and automation could in theory be great for us. I think the bigger question is, are we going to have a human society, and who's leading the society, and are they going to encourage a human society? The part of the problem is all these technologies are being used to centralize control. So for example, IT and digital technology should have facilitated tremendous decentralization, and it was government policy and enforcement that made sure it didn't. If anything, it should have made small business more competitive And it was really used, in fact, to do the opposite, to consolidate everything into corporations. So AI and automation and quantum computing, these are all just tools. And the question comes back to the governance system. Are the tools used in a way that's human and lead to an advanced society, or are the tools used in a way that's inhuman and leads to a, you know, an inhuman society?
Well, I have a feeling which way we might go, and I have a feeling which way we should go, and they're different.
Well, I hate to say this, it comes back to the 5%. What are we going to do? And it comes down to each one of us. What are we going to do? Because, as I said, the farmer can't run the farm without the chickens helping.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a little bit of optimism, and I hope people are listening. And I hope that we don't walk, what was Shakespeare's line, gently into that good night, I think is the line from Shakespeare. And I should know every word of Shakespeare, being British.
I come back to optimism because my personal experience with litigating against the Department of Justice is that our reality is first and foremost spiritual, and the greatest power on this planet is spiritual powers. You know, and there's an interdimensional aspect to what's going on the planet and what can go on. And the reality is we have to be worthy and invite in the powers of the light. And if we do, that's the most powerful force on the planet.
And when you talk about the powers of the light, are you talking about something that is supernatural? Are you talking about organized religion?
What I'm talking about, there is a divine intelligence that operates on this planet. And my way of understanding it is by experiencing it and seeing it act, you know, seeing miracles happen again and again. I mean, I have to tell you, Howard, it's impossible that I'm alive. And if you look at the stories of how I'm alive, it's miracle after miracle. And I've gotten to the point where I just sort of count on them because I'm not getting out of here without them. So, But I've seen them operate, and I know that, you know, that they're present. And so the universe is intelligent, and it's full of light. It's full of intelligence. And when are we? I'll give you a perfect example. My favorite story is a story of the psychoanalyst Carl Jung. And Jung, and this gets us into the whole morphogenic fields and the field and how the field operates and works. But Jung had a patient come to see him who was an aristocrat, a very wealthy woman. And she came in to see him and she said, you know, I'm not going to give you my name. I'm only coming once. And here was a story. As a young woman, she'd fallen in love. She'd gone to medical school and then fallen in love with her best friend's husband. And the way she resolved the tension was by murdering her best friend. She could, you know, being a doctor, she could figure out how to do it. She got away with it, married the best friend's husband, and then everything in her life started to go wrong. And she had beautiful wolfhounds who suddenly all died, and she was a horsewoman, and suddenly the horses would buck and rear, and she couldn't ride them. And she got pregnant, and right after she got pregnant, her husband died, and then she had the child, and the child hated her.
So this is big-time karma. Wow.
Right, no, it's big-time karma. And finally, she told Jung the reason she'd come to see him was to try and clear the story, and so that she could have a life again. But she told Jung wherever she was, the birds would stop singing. She said, the birds knew. And I do believe that. I believe that there is ultimately, there is some place in the field, in our shared consciousness, where there are no secrets. And one of the things that's destroying our society, our economy, is we're choking to death on our own karma. And we've got to clear the field. And part of that is... it's not just clearing the field, but accessing the power of the spiritual and the divine intelligence. That's how you start to build an advanced civilization. And of course, that means we're going to have to come out of secrecy, and we're going to come out of... I mean, right now, in the United States, the establishment is so subsidized and privileged, it's frightening, and it's destroying the economy. You can't... an economy cannot afford these kinds of privileges.
But I think it works everywhere. You know, here in the UK, we have the constant debate about high pay. There are people on ridiculously small wages. A lot of people that I know, and some of the stuff that I do, pays silly, low money. But right. There are people who are earning at the top levels salaries that have grown by staggering amounts that defy all logic. It seems right. that, and I don't want to be sounding like some kind of communist or something like this, but it seems like all the money's going from the bottom to the top.
Right. It's called privileges. Hmm. So I'll give you an example. And here's the problem we're facing. I did some very innovative mortgage transactions when we were lead financial advisor for HUD. And what we did was we got the optimization technology that AT&T Bell Laboratories had used to route telephone calls, and we used it to optimize mortgage bids. And I was hanging out at AT&T Bell Labs one day. They had used that technology to route aircraft airline scheduling. So, you know, if you've got thousands of pilots and thousands of stewardesses and they all have preferences on when they want to go and where they want to go on what routes and everything, it gets very complicated to do the scheduling. And so they use the software to do the scheduling. But over long periods of time, they were able to go back and say, what's the cost of a rule? What's the cost of a union rule? What's the cost of a government rule? How much was the whole model sub-optimized because of one rule? And one of the things they discovered was the senior pilots had privileges, you know, so they would get the rights to, you know, to get what they wanted first. What they discovered was if the senior pilots had given up their privilege, the privilege so sub-optimized the model that the pilots would have gotten more of what they wanted if they'd been willing to give up the privileges. Because having to rig it for, well, but that is exactly what is happening in the economy today. The establishment is rigging everything for themselves in a way that so sub-optimizes the pie that everybody's poorer, including them.
Well, there's a lot to do. Some people may say that you're aiming for some kind of utopia, and it's never going to happen.
No. I'm not. I believe in democratic process and markets. Markets work. We ought to try them. It's just what Gandhi said. He said, Western civilization, it's a great idea. We ought to try it.
Catherine, it's great to talk with you. You know, I get emails these days from people saying, Howard, you interrupt your guests all the time. You don't let them tell their stories. And emails from people saying, you didn't challenge that guest. Why didn't you? She was saying all that stuff about Donald Trump. She was saying all that stuff about Brexit. You didn't leap in there. I cannot win. So I'm saying to those people who are about to email me, I think that they should, if you like to receive email from people, they should contact you.
Yeah, that's fine. They can just send something to customer service at Solari.com.
Solari.com. Catherine, enjoy Amsterdam. Well, no, it's not Amsterdam. Enjoy the Netherlands.
I will. Thank you, Howard. Always a pleasure.
We'll talk again soon. Take care. Catherine Austin Fitz, your views on what she had to say, welcome. I'm sure she would welcome hearing them too. So I'll put a link to her website so you can communicate with her on my website, theunexplained.tv. We have more great guests in the pipeline here at The Unexplained and big developments coming too. Thank you very much for your support in all kinds of ways. It's nice to know that you're there. So until we meet again here on The Unexplained, my name is Howard Hughes. I am in London and please stay safe. Please stay calm, and above all, please stay in touch. Take care. Bye-bye.